to this hearing of the D.C. Rental Housing Commission. I am Chairman Michael T. Spencer, and I am joined by my colleague, Commissioner Lisa M. Gregory. Today is November 28, 2018, and the time is 11:05 a.m. We are convened in the Commission's hearing room, which is located at 441 4th Street Northwest, Suite 1140 B North, Washington, D.C. We are here pursuant to D.C. Law 610, the Rental Housing Act of 1985, as amended. This hearing, noticed at 11 a.m., is in regards to the housing accommodation located at 744 Girard Street, Northwest, Washington, D.C. The tenant petition number is RHTP 16 30857. The case is styled Eric Henderson, tenant appellant, versus Girard House Cooperative LCA, the Todd Gorton Companies LLC, housing providers appellees. The commission notes that there are parties seated before it and would ask that you identify yourselves for the record, beginning with the tenant appellant.
Good morning. My name is Catherine Denny. I am from the D.C. Tenants Rights Center, and I'm here representing the tenant, Eric Henderson.
Thank you. As for the housing providers, appellees.
Good morning. May it please the commission. My name is Kate Erklauer, and I represent the housing providers.
Thank you. I'll briefly explain the commission's procedures. Our rules are pretty similar to those of D.C. Court of Appeals. Each party will have 20 minutes to present its case, beginning with the tenant appellant counsel. The counsel for the tenant appellant may preserve up to 5 minutes of its 20 minutes for rebuttal following the presentation of the housing provider's appellee's case. The housing provider's appellee's must present all of its arguments within the 20-minute time frame and will have no rebuttal time. And its discretion, the commission may allow additional time if we ask plenty of questions to occupy a large portion of your 20 minutes. Our decision will be issued in writing and sent to the parties. We do not request nor will we accept any post-hearing submissions from either party. If you haven't, please make sure your cell phones are silenced and other electronic equipment. Are there any preliminary matters that we need to discuss? Hearing none, and I just need to make sure, would you like to reserve your 5 minutes for rebuttal?
Yes, please, Commissioner.
Okay, when you're ready, it's your show.
Thank you. Mr. Henderson appeals two findings by the administrative law judge here. As you're aware from our brief and notice of appeal, Mr. Henderson is appealing the finding that Mr. Henderson's rent increase claims are barred in their entirety by res judicata, where Mr. Henderson had a pending tenant petition and landlord-tenant action at the same time and chose to go forward on the landlord-tenant action first rather than requesting a Drayton stay. And the second issue, or the second finding, is that the housing provider did not retaliate against Mr. Henderson by locking Mr. Henderson out of his garage unit on February 10th of 2017. So just under 2 weeks prior to the evidentiary hearing in this case.
Can I interrupt quickly? You mentioned that Mr. Henderson decided to focus on the LTB case instead of requesting a Drayton stay. Can you elaborate as to why he did not request a stay?
So in his landlord-tenant branch case, he was seeking an order for repairs. So he had filed on September 2nd his tenant petition case. His trial was set for October 4th in the landlord-tenant branch case. It was, I guess, advice of counsel that because of primary jurisdiction and because rent increase claims cannot be heard in the landlord-tenant case, that he would not be waiving those claims in order to proceed on the landlord-tenant branch case. But the reason he did want to proceed rather than request a Drayton stay was that he wanted to achieve an order for repairs as soon as possible. So that was the reason there.
Thank you.
And so I guess I would first like to address the res judicata issue. So specifically, I guess, 3 points. The first is that this is a huge public policy issue that could really affect rent control and district tenants. That while this is potentially a small rent increase for one individual in this case, that this finding could really affect how rent control is decided. Because since landlord-tenant cases are often decided by default judgments, they are often, the tenants are often unrepresented, that it would, if there is a finding that a tenant is barred from ever challenging rent increases, if they have a prior landlord-tenant branch judgment, that could really lead to a runaround, around rent control. And so it would mean that a landlord could essentially perfect a rent increase by filing a landlord-tenant branch case and having a tenant be either unknowingly or unable to be filing a tenant petition to challenge to increase. And that because of the summary nature of landlord-tenant branch cases, that it's just unrealistic to assume that most tenants would understand that that's a right that they'd be waiving by either not showing up to a landlord-tenant branch proceeding or not raising that issue. And I guess within the policy realm, there's also this equity argument that the Court of Appeals has already allows the housing provider to proceed on in a landlord-tenant branch action on the undisputed rent amount. So if a tenant raises the issue of an unlawful rent increase, they can request a Drayton stay, but then the housing provider is still allowed to proceed on the undisputed rent amount and is able to kind of separate those two claims and does not waive their claim to this rent increase. And so tenants should equitably be afforded the choice of whether to proceed in a landlord-tenant branch action as well. Many tenants would not do so. Many tenants would prefer to proceed in a tenant petition rather than proceed in a landlord-tenant branch case because they're facing an eviction in landlord-tenant branch. However, in Mr. Henderson's case, he was seeking an order for repairs as soon as possible, and that was something that he couldn't achieve in his tenant petition case. So if housing providers are allowed to proceed in an eviction action without having their right to pursue a rent increase, it's unreasonable that a tenant may not be afforded that choice as well. And I guess the second main point that I would like to address outside of the policy issue is that the Rental Housing Commission has already ruled on this issue. So there have been two Rental Housing Commission decisions in which the Rental Housing Commission has found that a tenant's rent control claims are not subject to res judicata because of the doctrine of primary jurisdiction. And this finding is particularly clear in the case of Bobby Fisher v. Peters, which is tenant petition 23,261, and it's a Rental Housing Commission decision issued on September 5th of 1996. And the commission overturned the examiner's decision to dismiss the tenant's rent increase claims based on the doctrine of res judicata. And they specifically stated that the doctrine of res judicata stops relitigation of not only every ground of recovery or defense actually presented in an action, but also as to every ground which might have been presented. And, or however, the tenant petition before the RACD, the tenant attempted to litigate before the RACD the issue of violations of the Act by the housing provider, which could only properly be litigated by this agency. And so a similar decision was, there was a similar holding in Bedell v. Clark. In that one, the Rental Housing Commission held that even though the tenant had a prior small claims and landlord-tenant branch cases with the same housing provider, that the issues raised in the tenant petition regarding the legality of a rent increase weren't barred by res judicata because the rent increase claim could not have been litigated in the prior case, and that was due to the same doctrine of primary jurisdiction, that the rent administrator is the only body that can decide a rent increase claim. And so in both cases, the Rental Housing Commission did not find that a tenant was required to request a Drayton stay. And so just to I guess, briefly address the housing provider's arguments that there are two Court of Appeals decisions that address res judicata in landlord-tenant branch cases. And so I guess both of those, there's the Shin case and the Barton case. Both cases find that a tenant is precluded from later raising a claim that could have been adjudicated as a defense in the tenant's landlord-tenant branch action, but neither address the specific issue about primary jurisdiction and where a rent, or what happens in the case where a rent increase claim couldn't actually, or defense couldn't actually be litigated or adjudicated in the tenant branch, in the landlord-tenant branch action. And so I guess the final point on res judicata is that if the commission does find that res judicata does apply, it should only apply to the time period covered by the prior landlord-tenant branch action. So in Mr. Henderson's case, the landlord-tenant branch action covered a period of non-payment of rent where he was withholding his rent from April 2016 through the date of the trial, which was October of 2016. And so since it only covered that time period, we would ask that that the commission find that if it is going to be limited or that res judicata does bar the rent increase claim, that it only does so for that period of time. So res judicata itself only covers claims up to the date of the prior judgments. The landlord-tenant branch judgment was on October 4th of 2016. And the Court of Appeals has found that housing conditions claims, so not rent increase claims, but housing conditions claims, which are often very similar, and defenses that may have been raised by tenants in a landlord-tenant action are not barred by res judicata for the time period before or after the landlord-tenant branch matter. And that's in a recent decision by the Court of Appeals that we had cited in our brief. So that's Smith v. Greenway Apartments, 150 Atlantic 3rd, 1265. And that's a D.C. Court of Appeals case from 2016. And also, just in this case itself, the administrative law judge did allow the tenant to go forward on housing conditions violations that were ongoing from the date of the prior judgment. And similarly here, he's still being charged this unlawful rent increase, and that unlawful rent increase is ongoing past that date of the final judgment. And I guess this rent increase, I should, just to write a brief background, his rent was increased from $900 to $968 in October of 2015. And so there's a period of time both before the landlord-tenant action where he was charged an increase that was not properly filed with the Rental Accommodations Division, and then after the landlord-tenant branch judgment, it's an ongoing, the rent increase has continued. So he is still being overcharged. So in conclusion, the tenant asked for the commission to reverse the administrative law judge's findings that res judicata bars any challenge to Mr. Henderson's rent increase based on the precedent of the former Rental Housing Commission decisions and policy reasons in favor of protecting rent control in the district. And that alternatively, if the commission does find that res judicata applies, that it be limited to only that time period. So the second issue that we are seeking to raise on appeal is the administrative law judge's ruling that retaliation or that the housing provider is not liable for retaliation for locking Mr. Henderson out of his garage unit less than 2 weeks prior to the evidentiary hearing in this matter. So Mr. Henderson argues that the administrative law judge failed to apply her own findings of fact to the law here. And instead that the findings of fact that she did find are consistent with a finding of retaliation. And so I guess first it appears that the administrative law judge ruled that the tenant did make a facious showing of retaliation. She specifically stated that tenant has established a prima facie claim of retaliatory action, and that's on the final order at page 27. It is somewhat unclear whether she is specifically saying that all of the acts that we were alleging that were retaliatory were considered retaliatory acts, or if she's, but she doesn't seem to limit her statement there. So it's our understanding that she was making a finding that the tenant has established a prima facie claim of retaliatory action for the garage unit termination. And then once a retaliatory act is established, the housing provider must prove by clear and convincing evidence that a legitimate non-retaliatory motive for that act. And so I would particularly ask the commission to review the Court of Appeals decision in Gomez for guidance as to the burden of the housing provider in proving a non-retaliatory motive, because it is our argument that the housing provider has not established or has not overcome its own burden in order to prove a non-retaliatory motive here, and that the judge did not specifically state a non-retaliatory motive in her decision. So in the Court of Appeals decision, Gomez versus Independence Management of Delaware, that's 967 Atlantic 2nd, 1276, and it's at page 1290, 1291. This is DC Appeals Court decision from 2009. In Gomez, they specifically state that a retaliatory motive may taint an action that would otherwise be lawful. So just because a case or an action by a landlord is lawful, it does not mean that it's not retaliatory. And I mean, to decide otherwise would be very, would kind of undermine the entire purpose of the retaliation statute. For example, if there are a lot of things that a landlord could do that may be lawful, but is still for the purpose of making a tenant's life very difficult, or to retaliate against a tenant for asserting their rights. And so in this case, not only does it say that just because an action's lawful doesn't mean that it's not retaliatory, they also state that a landlord must, at a minimum, come forward with a legitimate, non-retaliatory reason for the challenged action, and that it will not suffice merely to articulate a legitimate, non-retaliatory reason, because the legislature has assigned a substantial burden of proof to the landlord, and that's clear and convincing evidence. So here are the final findings of fact from the final order, and the judge's order denying the housing provider's motion for reconsideration are insufficient to determine the non-retaliatory motive. So the administrative law judge makes specific findings here that are inconsistent with her final conclusions of law. She doesn't state the motive of the housing provider in particular, but she does explain, I guess, a little bit about what the landlord's purpose might be. So in the final order, it states, the garage lease signed by tenant and housing provider calls for an immediate termination of the garage lease if the monthly fee is not paid on time. Nonetheless, housing provider did not terminate tenant's garage lease as soon as tenant stopped paying, nor did demand payment at any time during the months the landlord-tenant case was pending. When asked why no action had been taken once the garage rent was in arrears, Mr. Jackson testified that the housing provider decided there are too many things going on at one time and opted not to deal with that issue until the landlord-tenant branch case was resolved. So I guess we would argue that just saying that there were too many things going on at one time is not a sufficient non-retaliatory basis for to explain why their actions were not retaliatory here. And further, the judge finds kind of additional findings in her order denying the housing provider's motion for reconsideration. Specifically states that based on actions taken by tenant by the property manager after the landlord-tenant case concluded, this administrative court found that Mr. Jackson's credibility lacking. It seemed that the housing provider, through Mr. Jackson, who was the property manager, purposely tried to make tenant's life difficult. Mr. Jackson's refusal to provide tenant with a copy of his rent ledger until he was locked out of the garage, as well as housing provider's overall slow response to addressing the housing code violations and ordered repairs characterize the passive-aggressive approach to retaliation. So it seems that she's almost making a finding of retaliation for terminating the garage lease in her own order for denying the housing provider's motion for reconsideration.
Okay, Counselor, we're going to have to stop there.
Okay.
And go to the housing providers.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. I'll begin just by responding to several points that opposing counsel made. First, the chairman asked why the tenant didn't request a stay, a Drayton stay in the case below, and Ms. Denny stated that the basis for not doing so was that he wanted to proceed to a judgment in that case because he wanted an order for repairs. Requesting a Drayton stay would not have cut off tenant from requesting such an order. If the case had been stayed, the tenant would have been entitled to seek an order for a temporary restraining order or a preliminary injunction. So it's not credible that the tenant was precluded by exercising both its rights to proceed to the rent increase claim and to an equitable remedy, because that remedy would have been available regardless of the Drayton stay. As for the tenant's argument that public policy favors allowing a tenant to proceed to judgment landlord-tenant and then later seek a reduction in rent based on a rent increase, that's also not really consistent with how landlord-tenant law works. The reason that a landlord is entitled to request to proceed in a landlord-tenant case at a lower rent level is because the tenant remains in possession during the pendency of a landlord-tenant case and a Drayton stay, and while the claim is being litigated at the OAH. The reason that the landlord has the option to elect that is because the tenant is in possession. Thus, the tenant is always protected when they're seeking to litigate their rent increase claim. And like I said, if they want some injunctive relief, they're free to seek that relief. It's not as if it's a bankruptcy stay and the trial court across the street is completely barred from litigating any claims. So those two public policy arguments just really don't pass muster.
Can you speak on the counselor's argument, basically saying if this practice was allowed, it could perfect rent increases by just the housing provider just has to file a court case and it'll perfect the rent increase without having to go through the administrative process?
Well, first of all, a landlord can't just file a court case. There has to be an actual non-payment of rent. So, you know, the landlord will first have to surreptitiously take an unlawful rent increase and then somehow dupe the tenant into not paying rent and then file a landlord-tenant case and then somehow achieve, I don't know, improper service so that the tenant can't come. I mean, if that parade of horribles happened, that would be a void judgment. And if the tenant later found out about it and said, hey, this is all wrong, I was current in my rent, the landlord's taken an unlawful rent increase, they would be entitled to vacate that judgment based on there being a void judgment. I don't think it's credible to say that a tenant really has an interest in protecting their right to appeal a rent increase that is greater than their interest in showing up to court to avoid eviction. So, I mean, if a tenant is worried and concerned about their landlord's behavior, the time that they're going to want to show up and protect their rights and litigate those rights is when they're facing eviction. So I don't think that it really passes muster that a tenant is going to be precluded from litigating any of those claims simply by the application of res judicata.
And this may be my last question for you before I'll let you continue. Yeah. It's a few things I wanted to get you to discuss. Can you explain the basis for the reduction from 968? I'm assuming from 968 to 900 and then back to 968. Can you talk about that reduction and then how that increase was done?
Your Honor, I'm sorry. I was not counsel below,
okay.
And that was not fully, because that part of the
understand
issue was not.
Understand that.
So I would not feel comfortable. My understanding is it was a credit that was then reversed. So I think that gets into the propriety or impropriety of the increase, and I'm
okay.
Sorry I can't respond.
I respect that. Thank you.
As to counsel's arguments that Fisher is controlling, I would disagree because that case was issued before the court's Court of Appeals finding in Shin versus Portals and Barton, which require a tenant to raise every legal defense in a landlord-tenant case or to risk the application of res judicata. And it's not true that the tenant couldn't assert this claim as a legal defense in the landlord-tenant branch. The issue of a rent level is directly at bar when the landlord-tenant court is making a determination on a non-payment of rent case. And by comparison, the court in Barton in 2003 held that failing to raise every legal defense, including in that case a claim of racial discrimination, operated as a race judicata bar to later raising that claim. So to say that the tenant couldn't have, in his landlord-tenant case, raised the issue of an improper rent increase as a defense is inconsistent with the law, where things that are so far afield as racial discrimination are required to be raised in the landlord-tenant branch or to be waived. And those two cases came both after the Fisher case, the Housing Commission case cited by tenant. As to tenant's claim that the court erred in not allowing the tenant to litigate the issue of the rent increase for the period after the judgment in the landlord-tenant case, as we've briefed in our papers, that issue has never been raised before. It was not raised in response to the housing provider's motion to dismiss. It wasn't raised in a motion for reconsideration. It wasn't raised during the evidentiary hearing, and it wasn't raised in the notice of appeal, so that argument has been waived by failure to properly assert it. Moving on to the garage lease. First, as we've briefed, the garage lease, first of all, it's a parking spot. There's a license agreement if you look at Respondents Exhibit 215. It's actual parking spot license agreement, which is not within the landlord-tenant relationship. It's a separate agreement. It's not part of the housing accommodation. And for that reason, the Commission and the OAH lack jurisdiction to make any determination with respect to that lease. It's a separate contract. And even were it not a separate contract, the OAH did not err in finding that there was no retaliation, because the OAH properly set forth the standard for finding retaliation. The administrative law judge invoked the presumption, and then she went through and described in multiple sections different conduct by the housing provider, some of which she found retaliatory, but specifically with respect to this garage termination, she found that there was no dispute that the tenant hadn't paid the parking space rent as required by the contract. Given that undisputed fact, and the undisputed fact that the contract required termination upon non-payment, it was not only a lawful termination of the rent of the parking spot license, but it was required by contract.
So why didn't they terminate earlier when you stopped paying for the parking space? Like, why did they wait to terminate?
I don't, Your Honor, I mean, what was said by the property manager was that there was a lot going on. I mean, allowing the housing, the tenant, the benefit of using that parking spot while perhaps there were complicated issues being litigated in terms of what money was in the registry, what was owed for, you know, where the money was owed. You know, he was given, if anything, the benefit of the doubt. He was given notice. I believe the record demonstrates that he didn't pay for many months over the course of the landlord-tenant action. The landlord didn't take action yet then. The landlord, in the finding fact number 51, the housing provider, the ALJ, found that the landlord notified the tenant that the garage rent was due. The tenant still didn't pay. And then it was a notice of termination was issued in January, and it wasn't until February 2017 that it was actually terminated. So there was ample opportunity and notice to the tenant by the housing provider of this arrearage. And I think that it can't be held against the housing provider that, if anything, they allowed a passage of time. They allowed the air to clear after the landlord-tenant action was done. The money still hadn't been paid, and they gave him that benefit, followed by proper notice. And here it's undisputed that that rent wasn't paid, the parking garage space wasn't paid.
And am I correct in understanding that your assertion is that the act doesn't cover the parking space anyway, so we wouldn't have jurisdiction?
Right, Your Honor. Okay. It's not as if this is an amenity that is attendant to the lease. It's as if, for example, I was thinking last night, like if the housing provider operated a Blockbuster. I mean, it's hard to think about other rental agencies anymore, but like if there was a Blockbuster downstairs that the housing provider owned and the tenant, you know, had a bunch of late DVDs and the housing provider said, you can't rent here anymore, that wouldn't be retaliation because that is separate and aside from the housing provider's relationship with the tenant vis-a-vis the rental accommodation. We're talking about a separate facility, a separate license agreement.
So just so I'm clear, is the assertion that the act only covers the actual accommodation? And so, for instance, if the housing provider offered a gym for residents and he paid to go to the gym, like he paid to go to the pool, the act wouldn't cover those things. It only covers the unit itself.
Well, I think that there's a fine line when it comes to something like that. Say there's like a pool and a gym, and the tenant is required, in many of these luxury buildings, the tenant is required, for example, to pay an amenity fee. They're required to pay that amenity fee, and then they're given access to that. And then for some reason, the landlord terminated that amenity. That might be a different argument. But here, what we have is a wholly separate contract that the tenant entered into with the housing provider that provides for this parking spot. So I'm not sure that it only covers an accommodation, but I think in this case where we have a completely discrete contract that is distinct from the housing accommodation, that it is different and that the commission and the OAH lack jurisdiction.
So any non-mandatory amenity fee, basically?
I would argue so.
Okay, thank you.
But I would also argue, even setting that aside, that the ALJ the housing provider met her burden, and the ALJ adequately articulated her reasons for finding that this particular act, while she found other things retaliatory, this particular act was consistent with the party's relationship and was not a retaliatory act.
Arguably, the ALJ shouldn't have dealt with it off if it wasn't under the
act. I don't believe that it was raised below this lack of jurisdiction, but as I've briefed in my paper, that the lack of jurisdiction is not a waivable argument, and so I'm raising it here.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thank you.
And I believe that covers everything I wanted to reach, unless the commission has any other questions.
Any questions?
Thank you.
We're going to keep you brief because we gave you 20 minutes earlier, so we're going to keep you brief on your rebuttal.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I guess just to briefly discuss the jurisdiction argument, the housing provider fails to address the actual statute for retaliation, which does not say that the act taken by a housing provider must be even related to the actual rental unit, that it has to be something that is done to inconvenience the tenant, and it's something that's done subsequently to some act by the tenant asserting his rights. And so there is no limit specifically stated in either the statute or the regulation for the tenant to be making a prima facie showing of retaliation. And so if the housing provider instead wants to argue as their non-retaliatory motive that this doesn't have to do with the rental unit and doesn't have to do with the tenant's actions in asserting their rights as a basis for why this is a non-retaliatory motive, I could see that being an argument. But in terms of jurisdiction, there is no jurisdictional limitation to what type of action is required under retaliation. And then I guess very quickly to what the housing provider kind of characterizes as a parade of horribles for perfecting rent increases in landlord-tenant branch cases, I think she's has a very good amount of experience in landlord-tenant court and is aware of the fact that even when possession should be a very good reason for a tenant to go to court, that's not always realistic for a tenant, and that tenants often default and often don't know what their rights are. And so the parade of horribles is not really that unrealistic, and that it's something really could impact a lot of tenants without them realizing the rights that they're waiving. So I guess I would respectfully disagree with her characterization there. And I guess those are two main points that I wanted to address. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you both for your zealous advocacy for your clients. And also for introducing me to the term of parade of horribles. It's a pretty fun term. So it's now 11:40 a.m., and this hearing is hereby adjourned. Thank you.